That breaking news from the Supreme Court, a leaked draft opinion reportedly shows the nation's high court could be set to overturn the landmark 1973 abortion rights ruling Roe v. Wade.
The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics program for May 4th. May the 4th be with you. 2022, it's your old pal Justin Robert Young joining you from Austin, Texas. Good Lord, sometimes you are begging for something to chatter about. Other times your cup runneth over. That's one of these episodes. Boy, howdy, the entire political world rocked by Politico.com late Monday night when they published what we now know to be an accurate early draft of a very hotly anticipated Supreme Court case with this headline. Five of the Supreme Court justices are set to overturn Roe versus Wade. Big stuff. We will go through all of the implications, not only what would happen in Congress, but also in the midterms, and we do a little bit of digging into how gigantic a leak from the Supreme Court on a case like this is, and do a little reckless speculation as to who might have done it. Or at least like the broad strokes of who, like not the name, but like the type of person that might have done it, including one wild conspiracy theory. We are also going to give you the latest Ohio results. Full disclosure, I'm recording this at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon Central Time. So the first segment of this will be those Ohio results. I will be doing them as they come in or when we know who did what. We will find out the results of everything. So I'm not going to pretend like I know them right now. Don't worry. In a few seconds after you hear the But First music, I'll be right into it. Also, we have a great interview with a man by the name of Matt Sinkowitz, who has a brand new book exploring the world of conservative comedy. See, the way that Matt sees it, the world of conservative comedy can kind of fit into a mall. And while you have your big box stores that have gigantic audiences like Greg Gutfeld, you also have some smaller boutique shops, maybe even some kiosks like the Babylon Bee or Steven Crowder. But what troubles Matt is that there's also a deep, dank basement with some of the most offensive S posters and streamers and political hosts that you can imagine. His point is that because conservative comedy is marginalized, they tend to intermingle more than you might think. I think it's going to be an interesting interview. I think that you guys, whether or not you agree or disagree with him, you are going to be interested to hear in his perspective. I thought it was a great convo. All that. But first.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Wow. I got to say, I thought this would feel good. It feels even better than I thought it would. Thank you.
That is J.D. Vance, the Republican nominee for Senate in Ohio, the same race that we went out there and covered. Indeed, our thoughts were correct that the Trump endorsement was the thing that mattered the most. But let's go ahead and take a look here at the unofficial results as of 10 p.m. Central Time. That is 11 there on the East Coast. J.D. Vance with a fairly commanding 32% win. That puts him about 10 points higher than the polls had him, trailing behind Josh Mandel, one of the front runners of this race at 23. And indeed, the Matt Dolan surge was for real, because Matt Dolan effectively ties Josh Mandel at 23% and change. So let's really kind of break down exactly what that means. That means that 50% of this electorate, roughly 50% of this electorate, over 50% of this electorate are Trump people, because either they were Trump voters that would go where Trump said they should go, and that's J.D. Vance, that's 32%, or they were Trump voters, but they didn't like J.D. Vance. That's 23%. Like, because Josh Mandel effectively in the final few weeks of this race was running a "we are the true mantle of Trump" campaign. Matt Dolan surged as soon as Trump made a call, and he was the only person that was, I mean, if not the never Trump candidate, probably somewhere between that and the I don't want to acknowledge Trump candidate, and he got 23%. So effectively what we can say in Ohio is that the never Trump electorate is about the same as the not the guy that Trump endorsed electorate, which is non-existent. And to be totally honest, if we're not in a race to say who can be the most MAGA, I believe J.D. Vance is a candidate that can sway them back. You know, this is a fairly interesting election, and one for which I would put J.D. Vance as the real favorite against Tim Ryan, who won fairly easily the Democratic primary in this particular election. Mike Gibbons, who we also covered, only gathered 11.63% of the vote as we talk to you right now. You know, goddamn, I gotta say, like, when I go to these places, I feel like I got a handle for them. Like, I told you that Mike Gibbons felt beaten and tired. I showed you that Josh Mandel needed somebody to come up after two speakers after him, after his own event, to launch bombs at J.D. Vance. And we see the result right here. So there we go. Mandel second, Gibbons third, or sorry, Dolan third, Gibbons fourth. J.D. Vance will advance to the general election. By the way, Mike DeWine fairly handily won his Republican primary against two right-leaning challengers there. DeWine is not Kasich moderate, but certainly more moderate than some of the MAGA folks would prefer. So there we go. Ohio has been decided. J.D. Vance will meet Tim Ryan. All right, let's go ahead and get into the story that everybody is talking about, set fire to the entire political landscape late Monday night. And that is the Politico story leaking what we now know is an authentic February draft of the Mississippi abortion case that is written by Justice Alito and appears, or at least says, that the majority of the court is not only ruling to overturn the, or sorry, to sustain that law, but to overturn Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood. This obviously would be a seismic political event, the likes of which I can't remember a ton of equals to have a Supreme Court decision that has been the bedrock of politics reversed would be something that would have long lasting political ramifications. So I'm going to break this into three buckets here that I roughly think is kind of in order the biggest issues that are stemming from this. The first is what happens in Congress, because that's going to happen the earliest. Then what happens at the midterms, and then what the hell happened with this leak? Jesus. All right. Let's begin with Congress. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer released a very pointed joint statement slamming Trump, Republicans, and Mitch McConnell for allowing three justices to be appointed on the 45th president's term. That obviously is why there is now a conservative majority on the bench. Mitch McConnell responded, saying that the statements from Pelosi and Schumer, as well as Joe Biden, were further inflaming the situation that should have never happened, since this was all stemming from a leak of a month's old draft. So it is important to note here that Mitch McConnell's comments came before Chief Justice Roberts confirmed that this was real. At the time that Pelosi and Schumer and Biden released their statements, this was a leak that we did not know for sure was real beyond Politico's reporting. But here's the real question. Do the Democrats have the moves to do anything, considering they still do hold control of the White House, Senate, and House? And the answer seems to be no. Joe Manchin is both anti-filibuster busting without a bipartisan compromise and isn't a firebrand abortion rights activist. In March, he joined with Republicans to block the Women's Health Protection Act, which would enshrine Roe as law. So that leaves Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, both Republicans. That would require them crossing the aisle on a hot button issue. For a politician, one of those, either crossing the aisle or voting on a hot button issue, is death. To ask them to do two at once is nearly impossible. Still, Susan Collins did appear stung by this news, releasing a statement, quote, "If this leaked draft opinion is the final decision and the reporting is accurate, it would be completely inconsistent with what Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh said in their hearings, in our meetings, in my office." Let's flash back to that Kavanaugh hearing, as intense as it was. It was Susan Collins who cast the deciding vote that put him on the bench. And part of the reason why was because she said he believed that this was settled law, Roe versus Wade. Is that enough for Susan Collins to cross the aisle and attempt to convince her to subvert Senate norms to advance abortion rights? We shall see. It is worth noting that if you are doing your part to load up the blame train on this, that the late Harry Reid is one of the butterflies that created this hurricane. It was his nuclear option on federal judges that led to Mitch McConnell retaliating by instituting the same simple majority threshold for Supreme Court justices that gave him more leverage to hold out on Garland, and after the biggest upset in presidential history, two retirements and an untimely death later, we have three new justices and quite possibly a reversal on one of the most controversial decisions in court history. So, what happens in the midterms? Well, the Democrats will have something to run on that is totally disconnected from Joe Biden. As we've played on this show a few times, a few of these Senate candidates like Raphael Warnock and Catherine Cortez Masto and Mark Kelly in Arizona, the three most vulnerable statewide Democrats, have all run commercials that totally try to disconnect them from Joe Biden. Warnock, it was about insulin. For Mark Kelly, it was about him being a bipartisan astronaut. Not kidding. And for Cortez Masto, she had a commercial just come out where she was the champion of human trafficking, the champion against human trafficking, for the human trafficked. This is a hot button issue that turns out Democrats, and it has nothing to do that anything Biden has done. This will not only be big in statewide races like the ones I just mentioned and those for governor, but also House races and state government races. The criminalization of abortion would no longer be hypothetical. If Roe is gone, then states will decide. And if the states will decide, then liberals have a very good reason to go out and vote in November and beyond. But no matter the mood of the voters or whatever culture war issue of the day is on the table, the biggest issue that Democrats have going into these November elections is that they are, well, asleep. And they've been like that since Trump lost. Well, nothing is a bucket of ice water to wake up liberal voters like overturning Roe versus Wade. By the way, 13 states currently have so-called trigger laws on the books, which would make abortion illegal in that state the second that a Supreme Court decision like this came down the pike. Those are Arkansas, Idaho, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming. You can imagine that candidates like Beto O'Rourke will essentially rebrand his campaign in Texas to fight on this issue alone for the next 7 months. Is it enough? Well, we don't know. The economy will forever be the number one issue in any race, and right now the economy is bad and possibly getting worse. Also, while abortion is a rallying cry in very liberal cities, by and large, those areas already have state laws encoding abortion rights. And then there's the demographic question. The rallying cry from many abortion activists are that men should not be making laws to control women's bodies. But the data is not so clear cut on this. In fact, in a combination of studies about abortion support from 1972 to now, men are either on par or more supportive of a woman's right to an abortion, including in the case of rape, unmarried, mother self, wants no more kids, or can't afford one. The only category where women are measurably more supportive than men is the category of for any reason. And even then, it's in the single digits. The short answer to all of this is that we don't know. But I would watch for messaging from candidates in the middle of races right now. Which brings us to this. How in the hell did this story leak? Well, the previous two questions dealt with the chaos for which this will cause if it is indeed the final decision. We cannot move on without addressing how insane it is that this leaked. The Supreme Court is omuerta. It is a code of silence. They are technologically regressive. Everyone who knows anything has a tremendous amount to lose. Even if you're clerking for the Supreme Court, you have immense status within the legal community. Your future includes private practice, federal judge, hell, even a spot on the Supreme Court itself. You are in an elite group that will define the rest of your life. This institution, very, 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 very rarely leaks. And even when books are written about the court and drafts of decisions are cited or quoted, they happen after the decisions are made. For an early draft of a decision yet to be officially decided to leak, this decision specifically, is counter to the trust of that organization, which has held strong for years. Now, Chief Justice John Roberts, who incidentally fashions himself to be a court norms defender, did confirm the accuracy of the leak and began an investigation into who leaked it. So, to bring this segment to a close, let's engage in some reckless speculation. Is it a clerk? Well, that'd be a pretty high ladder to climb before jumping off it for media clout or political points. It would be like working your entire life, getting to your dream job, and quitting. But maybe that's exactly it. Someone decided to be a big 1% lawyer and then decided it wasn't for them, and instead wanted to get into the world of politics with a splash. Or maybe we're one degree removed and it's a significant other. Maybe a clerk brings the decision home, vents about what's happening, and the significant other decides that this information cannot be contained and leaks it to another DC friend who leaks it to Politico. Or then, there's this. A hack. All right. Get your Pepe Silvia conspiracy boards ready. The Politico scoop is credited to two reporters, Josh Gerstein and Alexander Ward. Gerstein is the legal affairs reporter. You'd expect that on a story like this. But Ward is the national security reporter for Politico. So let's say somebody hacks the Supreme Court and it's circulating in hacker channels. Is the person most likely to be tipped off about it covering national security? Possibly. Who knows? I do suspect we will find something about this because Chief Justice Roberts is somebody who I believe takes stuff like this extraordinarily seriously. But it's among the biggest scoops I can remember. And now that it's confirmed as accurate, I do believe that Politico was worthwhile or in their rights to publish it, no matter how it got to them. Look, there's no way that I can talk about this subject without it being among the most emotional things that people like to talk about. The emotional and philosophical resonance of the abortion issue is ingrained into almost all political conversation. Should this be accurate, the next few months will be intensely chaotic. And that's it. I can't tie a bow on it any tighter than that. Ladies and gentlemen, you can support this show in many ways, up to and including, you know, leaving a review. It's been a while since we've directly asked for folks to head on out to the podcast distributor of your choice and leave us a review. But it really does help. I don't think it helps with the algorithm. It does help with social proof. Especially if you're referencing things that are going on, especially if you're referencing the midterms, if you're referencing that I go out and actually cover stuff, if you're referencing the kind of analysis that we are bringing you on Roe versus Wade and other stuff, that really does help. It shows if people are looking for different perspectives that we bring a little something different. That's a totally free way that you can support the show. If you would like a paid way to support the show, then you need to head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That's our Patreon. For $3 a week, you get two bonus episodes each and every week. Double your PX3 enjoyment. And especially when we're on the road, like we will be in Pennsylvania, like we will be in Georgia, that means early or bonus, and often both, content from the front lines. Again, that is TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Thank you guys so much for your support. Actually have a weekend off coming up here, Pennsylvania after that, and then I believe another week, and then the final week of May, I am out in Georgia. Where, by the way, George W. Bush gathering around the man who defied Trump and at this point looks as if he is going to beat Purdue without the aid of a runoff.
Ooh. Hear about that?
TakePoliticsSeriously.com. For whatever reason, you guys, the listeners of this show, cannot get enough of our conversations about political comedy. Where it came from, what makes it funny, the lines between liberal political comedy and conservative political comedy. Hell, the lines between liberal political comedy and comedy. But there is a new book out that you guys are very much going to enjoy. The tome is called That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. It is authored by a man named Nick Marks and our guest today, Matt Sinkowitz. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
So what would you say right off the top is the fundamental difference between the conservative and liberal media complexes?
Yeah. So, on the one hand, we live in a world now where media, you know, functions on a set of logics that basically go across the board. You've got, an increasingly more targeted media, no matter where you are across the spectrum. You've got the role that algorithms are playing and, people, regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, you tend to only see stuff that comes from your general part of that spectrum. So that is true. But particularly on the stuff that I'm interested in, that we talk about in our book, one of the major differences is just the history of particularly political comedy and how it sort of impacts what we see today. So if we're talking about the left side of the political spectrum, that's traditionally been where there's been a sort of a dominant force in sort of center left liberal comedy. This is where I'd put SNL. This is where I'd put The Daily Show, these sort of big legacy institutions that, traditionally have had the biggest audiences. And there was a time when that was the only way to do media, right? Was to have a relatively big show, invest a bunch of money, try to get a big audience. The difference now, of course, is that, as you know, as podcasters know, as anybody who works in modern media knows, you don't need a big audience to justify a production. You need a good audience. You need a stable audience. You need an audience that's invested, even if it's not huge, if it is dedicated to you. And it's got good kind of holds together for an advertiser, it can work. And so that brings me to answer your question. On the right, particularly as it relates to comedy, the important players are largely relatively small podcasts, relatively small YouTube channels. There is the example of Greg Gutfeld, which we can get into, who's a little bit bigger. But these sort of smaller pieces that wouldn't have existed in the past before the sort of revolutions in new media, which made it so there wasn't really representation of that part of the political spectrum in comedy. And now there is. So the right-wing comedy complex, as we put it, is mostly made up of relatively small players who have really intense audience devotion and really tight demographics, very male, skew pretty young, and that they link up together, even if they're kind of from different parts of the right. Whereas on the left, we still have a more or less the domination, at least in terms of the way we think about it, in terms of those big institutions like SNL, Daily Show, that kind of thing.
Who would you put in that silo on the right, just so people can have an example of who you're talking about?
Yeah. So, we acknowledge that, when I talk about the American right, that can include a wide range of ideologies, and it can include ideologies that mostly don't get together on most things. And one of the arguments that we want to make is that they do get together in the world of comedy. So, there's a bunch of names. I'll throw them at you. We can dive into specifics on anyone you want. So, first and foremost, I'd say Greg Gutfeld's the first person you have to talk about these days. He's got his nightly late night show on Fox News, which is, in terms of ratings, really powerful. Competes with Colbert, beats Kimmel, beats The Daily Show in that time slot, at least in terms of airing, internet viewing and all that's a little complicated. So that's sort of the closest thing you'll have to that kind of big legacy institution. And then there's different sort of parts of the right wing world where comedy is becoming more and more viable. There is a libertarian world right? So the sort of leader in this general area, even though his politics are very complicated, is Joe Rogan, right?
Yep.
Rogan himself, I don't think you can call him right, left, or anything. But part of what his show does is bring in voices from sort of further out in the political spectrum with a lot of attention to that libertarian space. And so I would also
wonder there with Rogan that his podcast, while he is obviously a stand-up comedian and he often has stand-up comedians on,
and that's
they're not necessarily, you know, doing comedy per se, you know, if anything, the comedians are often talking about things that wind up getting everybody in trouble.
Yeah. Talking about mushrooms or vaccines or something, right?
Yeah,
100%.
Exactly.
And it's really tough to paint a brush with Rogan, but a big chunk of what he does is bring on people like the Legion of Skanks or Michael Malice or people who are Dave Smith, these people who are in that world. And they are comedians. They're doing, you're right, they're right. They're doing these sort of like hybrid things where they're talking politics, they're talking elk meat, they're talking, you know, whatever things you do.
Whatever. Yeah. The point is that it is a freewheeling conversation that goes 100%. In a million different places. While obviously they are stand-up comics who are wanting to get a laugh.
And they want to get a laugh. Even bigger than that, they're trying to draw people to their comedy podcasts. Right.
Yes.
Like the reason that they go on. So even if on there you have to play around in different ways, I don't know if you're familiar with the Legion of Skanks, like Jay Oakerson and Louis Gomez, when they go on to the, you know, Rogan, the point is to pull people back into their much more directly comedy branded spaces. So that's a big part of what we're talking about. There's also this world of right-wing satire, political sort of argument comedy. So the Babylon Bee is probably the best known example of this. That is a satire site. It's basically The Onion. It was originally aimed largely at evangelical Christian audiences, sort of satirizing that the excesses of that world. Now is a much more sort of broad-based right-wing answer to The Onion. Does less of the Christian stuff. Steven Crowder is a person in that world. He's the guy who goes to college campuses and you know, says that there are two genders, change my mind, and gets 100 million YouTube hits. You know, you might not think of him as a comedian, but that's what's on his business card. And I would say that
Crowder very much is somebody that I would say is probably more directly in a field that I would say is right wing comedy than Rogan. You know, he does
bits, he does
pranks, he does, you know, these kinds of things.
Yeah, we frame Rogan more as a sort of a carnival barker to many places, including this world that we're describing.
Yeah,
sort of drawing people in. Somebody we also, when we write about Crowder, when we write about the Babylon Bee, we talk a bit about Ben Shapiro, who is not a comedian himself, but is very into sort of comedy as culture war, like the left's destroying comedy and trying to sort of make a new, funnier right wing sort of political space. So we talk about that. And then there is also, as our book goes into, sort of that really dark area, right? So we talk about this notion of the right-wing comedy complex, just kind of like a mall, the way we sort of describe it, right? There's the big box store. That's like the Target, right? That's Greg Gutfeld and what Fox News has become. Then there's these specialty shops, right? And then we argue there, and that's the people I just described. And then we argue there is this dirty basement where extremists lurk. And the last part of our book is devoted to looking at truly sort of far extremist comedy. People put in that box would be somebody like a Nick Fuentes, who is a on again, off again YouTube personality who's always getting thrown off because he's, you know, a sort of radically anti-immigrant and a Holocaust denier and sort of in all these ways that he's sort of winking, and he does it as comedy bits. But the content is sort of geared towards those really ugly ideologies. And then we also discuss at sort of the far end of that a podcast such as The Daily Shoah, which is like a painful thing to say aloud. To be clear, that the joke, quote unquote, here, Shoah is the Hebrew term for the Holocaust, The Daily Shoah instead of Daily Shoah. It's pretty nasty stuff. A web comedy called Murdoch, which is lots of swastikas in it.
Gotcha.
And, you know, there's a difference between that and the other stuff we're talking about. And that's why we note we're talking about the whole spread here of things that are sort of in the right wing world, whether that's relatively moderate or absolutely extreme.
So I would imagine, and I have not, you know, spoken to them, but I would imagine that the Babylon Bee would probably personally react to saying, well, why do we have to be in this mall with a Holocaust denying a podcast? Why are they linked?
Yeah. So and this could be uncomfortable stuff. On the one hand, you have to be careful about guilt by association. You have to be careful about we're not saying that one equals the other. However, they go together in two ways, one a little abstract, one very concrete. One is that, you know, we do live in a sort of binarial kind of political system where we have two parties and we tend to cut it down the middle and look right and left. And so if you look right, if you look left, you'll find extremists too. And you could draw connections between more moderates to extremists. And that would be, I think, intellectually reasonable. But there is also a very specific element to it, which is partly because these right-wing comedy spaces are relatively small. What they do is they link up in really unusual alliances. So every one of these people, with the exception of the far, far right guys, will be on each other's shows. And that can make really interesting moments, right? So the Babylon Bee, which still is avowedly evangelical Christian in perspective, will bring on somebody like Michael Malice. Michael Malice is an anarcho-capitalist somethingist, like sort of extreme atheist. Totally, like nothing in common with the Babylon Bee whatsoever, except that they're both on that side of the dividing line. Right, that they both like to make fun of the libs, and that's sort of how the algorithm treats them. It like locks them together.
Yeah.
So the connection that I would make, and you can say if it's fair or not, is Babylon Bee will be happy to have on a character like Michael Malice, and Michael Malice will play games in this right wing troll world where, you know, it's always ironic, but it's deeply ironic, quote unquote, ironic anti-Semitism. You know, if you read his book, he's making jokes about people who are, you know, asking, quote unquote, the Jewish question. He's interviewing Sam Hyde, who is giving money to the defense fund of the editor of the Daily Stormer. They do connect. It doesn't mean they're equivalent, but the sort of edgy, trolly comedy world, which is just in bounds, connects to the world that's sort of beyond that and really out of bounds. And then that connects into the other spaces. So, you know, you can get from the Babylon Bee to the Daily Stormer in a very short number of moves. That doesn't make it their fault, but it is still a fact.
And this is a phenomenon that you don't believe exists on the left, that you can't connect a SNL personality to somebody with horrifying views?
No, that's not claims. No. Yeah. Okay. I haven't researched that. No. Sure. That is not a claim that I'm neutral on that claim. And I suspect that you can. The interconnectivity and interdependency of the sort of right wing comedy world is a bit different, I would argue, in that they tend to be these smaller institutions, smaller like podcasts and things that really do intermingle and intermix in a really direct way. So it's not sort of like, oh, he just sort of hung out with this guy once, but like he's on his show every few weeks or something along these lines. The connections are thicker. But no, I mean, I think that if somebody wanted to do the work and show that, you know, you could connect certain liberal perspectives that seem in bounds to ones that seem out of bounds, I'd be open to it and might be interested. I mean, I would want to see how thick those connections are, but, you know, possible.
Something that I've been fascinated with the world of political comedy is that it tends to find different physical mediums. And I don't mean that, you know, but I guess in a bygone era, it literally physical mediums of radios versus televisions or magazines versus newspapers. But now the platforms that certain ideologies enjoy tend to be kind of different. And you have seen, you know, the right very much become dominant in like message board culture, which bleeds into common grounds like Twitter. Do you think that partly, I mean, and this goes all the way back to me, like if you were to, you know, to lay out this foundation, when I hear liberal friends discuss like the Rush Limbaugh show, it will be, clips that they have seen from liberal outlets where Rush Limbaugh is saying the most incendiary thing that he will probably say 100%. That year, right? When you talk to conservatives about the Rush Limbaugh show, they talk to you about parody songs that they liked because Rush Limbaugh was very much a, you know, a morning show host that, you know, trafficked in a lot of those same ideas.
For sure.
I wonder whether or not part of any kind of interconnectivity is just because for whatever reason, conservative comedy tends to find itself in these areas apart from the channels by which liberal comedy does.
Yeah, no, I think that's 100% right. I think that that is what pushes towards a deeper level of connectivity. Maybe this will sort of spell out kind of what you're getting at. So let's take a character like Gutfeld.
Yeah.
Gutfeld does not compete with anybody else on the right side of the spectrum for late night comedy viewers. I mean, somebody on the right might enjoy Jimmy Kimmel. It's possible, but he's not. Yeah. Nobody else is really targeting. Right. And so
unless he goes head to head with South Park, that might be the only thing for which could compete with a Gutfeld viewer in my mind on cable.
Right. So, but it's very limited, right?
Yes.
So for Gutfeld, the other presences on the right side of the spectrum are all allies in a way. They're all people to bring on to the show so that fans from that other person learn about Gutfeld. Or for him to visit or have people from his show visit onto the other comedy spaces on the right side. And so the interconnectivity is a wagon circling in a way, and that there's not really competition at the moment. That'll change over time. But it's sort of an alliance building because it is limited in space. And I think you're right, limited to relatively smaller platforms. Right. Whereas on the left, and again, I mean, to call people like Colbert and, you know, Kimmel, they're center left sort of characters, but they are in direct competition with each other. They do not want to interconnect at all. I mean, they want the late night atmosphere to be kind of good and people to watch late night TV. They have a few interests that align, but mostly they want to knock each other out. And so the traditional dominance of the center left in that kind of comedy world turns it into a competitive space. Whereas the relative upstart nature on the right turns it into a space where, you know, mostly the people who are involved work together.
How much do you think, you know, something that we've spent a lot of time talking about on this show when it comes to political comedy is how explicit the politics have kind of grown specifically since Trump. You know, we had one of our guests is a former Jimmy Kimmel writer who was, you know, he left around the time that Trump was coming in. But he was describing when the monologue is normally getting written, at least before Trump, you would always save your best joke for last because you wanted the big funny joke to be what people think about when they're contemplating staying through the commercials. Yep. It eventually through Trump changed into what was dubbed the clapter moment where you made your most salient and witty political point, and that would keep the audience and certainly there's you know, a lot to be said about, you know, Colbert's his entire career kind of on late night rescued by the fact that he became a more explicitly political show. How much do you think has that phenomenon? Well, A, is it true in your mind? And B, do you think that the reaction to that has shaped conservative comedy?
Oh, 100%. I think it's a great observation. Look, Trump broke everything. We know that in terms of discourse, in terms of the way we talk about it, right? We could have a whole other discussion about policy and all that. But in terms of sort of culture, he broke everything. All the rules got mixed around. And you're pointing to exactly the right thing. I think it's fair to say that generally late night hosts have, you know, I mean, Jay Leno is a little different. I don't know where you put Johnny Carson. They've been centrist characters mostly with maybe a light center left orientation, but with a real dedication to going across the aisle. To putting together a show that can get the big chunk, the middle of the bell curve of American politics, which is, you know, historically relatively center. And as long as that was the case, there was not enough room on the right to make a really successful right focused comedy show, right? As long as Jay Leno is kind of doing the whole middle, or even you know, you could pre-Trump Colbert potentially, they're taking up too much of the right side of the middle to leave a good chunk for Greg Gutfeld. What happened with Trump, as you're pointing to, is that they really, in the Colbert world, the Kimmel world, really picked a side, really said we need to make clear that we are not aligned with this political movement, which we think is so terrible. And as a result, they it's not so much even sliding to the left as announcing that politics in a way that's going to turn off a certain amount of viewers who consider themselves on the right. And once they did that, once Colbert was happy sort of announcing that, and a lot of this was doing penitence, right? It's Jimmy Fallon mussing Trump's hair or Trump posting SNL, these things that people on the center left part felt really awful about, right? Once they really did their work to say we are completely distanced, right? We are not talking to people who are at all sympathetic to Trump. This opened up a lane for Gutfeld to come in and swoop up not just sort of people who are really hard partisans, but also a certain group of people who relatively centrist, but on the right side of things, who felt like they were being alienated by the mainstream guys.
You know, a part of what has seemingly made Gutfeld a success is that he kind of eschewed a little bit more of the off-kilter comedy that he was doing on Red Eye previously. And has kind of settled more into the idea of this is just another Fox panel, but maybe now jokes, they're going to make the memes inside of it. It's not even like jokes, right? It's just like, you know, now you can chant "Let's go, Brandon" at the end of your point in a way that you couldn't during the 6 o'clock hour. That might get you scolded by the line producer in the 6 o'clock hour.
Right. And they'll do sketches. They'll do skits. They'll, you know, sort of cheaply produce late night sketches and skits. But 100% Fox's move has been to blur those boundaries. Right. That has been what they've been doing for years. And you first thing you know is really right. Red Eye was a very adventurous show.
Yeah.
It did weird stuff, like really strange. I mean, it was on a 3 a.m. It had the ability to do that. So that is true. They've definitely on the one end sort of tempered. They've tempered the wildness of Gutfeld, but they've also sort of included more silliness in their daily coverage. So Gutfeld's not just deployed at night; he's also on the five. Jesse Waters, who is his sort of like, I guess, the Colbert to his Stewart, in some sense, that might be sacrilege to say to a lot of people, but he's also deployed earlier in the day. They're doing bits at the 5 o'clock hour, right? That's not like a hard news show, but it's still supposed to be a newsy show. And they're sort of blurring these boundaries up and down across the space. Fox News, I think, is at the vanguard of that. I wouldn't be surprised if we see that more broadly in cable news.
Yeah, I think so much of this is sort of tied up to the personalities of these channels where, you know, Fox News, you know, from Roger Ailes on, has been very almost old television steeped. And, you know, that's why the ladies wear skirts and they have their hair done up and they don't want any, you know, mousy looking reporters on unless they're from the other side and you don't care what they look like. And that 5 o'clock hour when people are getting off of work, they want it to be jovial and they want people to be to like each other and make almost like a morning show level of frivolity in a way that MSNBC and CNN specifically through the Trump years, you know, we're constantly covering the fall of Vietnam. Right. Like it was constantly a very dour sort of attitude. And I wonder, I mean, that to me is such a huge part of the modern conservative culture that is very dominant in the comedy, which is we're laughing and they're crying. And isn't that funny?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I think you got the two really key points there. It does have it's, you know, it has an old TV. It almost has an old sort of studio system feel to it. They develop a stable of stars at Fox News. They are able to create and promote their own people. You know, if you ask what's the difference between Gutfeld and Colbert, there are some, and you pointed some, but the biggest one is that, you know, you don't have Jennifer Lawrence coming on to promote a movie, right? You don't have the sort of celebrity culture, but they have created their own celebrity culture, right? It's smaller, but really intense. The Fox News personalities are wildly popular amongst Fox
gigantic
people.
Yeah.
I mean, I my co-author and I, Nick, we went to CPAC, the one right as COVID was coming in 2020, just to sort of, you know, see the scene. And it might as well be Jennifer Lawrence when Diamond and Silk or whoever character kind of comes in, only in that room, but it's not a small room. You know, I mean, it's a substantial space. So 100% they are creating stars and they're creating personalities. And of course, some of that's going to have to do with sense of humor and comedy. I actually forgot the second thing that I was going to say there. What else did you ask?
We were talking about the fact that the ethos specifically between right versus left that boils into comedy is that, my God, it's fun to be us because it sucks to be them and they're never happy.
Which is a huge part of the Gutfeld thing, right, is pointing to ways in which the left is supposedly over serious and dour and censorious. That is, if there's anything that connects this whole complex that we describe, it is that. It is that the left, this is a right wing view of the left. So I'm not saying it's accurate, but the way that they're successfully able to sell to the Fox News audience and whoever else, the idea that the left is constantly going to tell you, oh, you can't joke about that. Oh, you can't, you have to take that seriously. We can't be silly at this moment. And Trump's, of course, the greatest thing. The greatest example of that. So 100% the portrayal of on the right of the right as being able to laugh and the left is not is a main part of sort of the right wing view of things, and exactly the opposite of this traditional idea that's developed on the left that only the left can be funny.
Exactly. And that's what's fascinating to me is that it's almost a one for one flip of what the like classic the Stewart era Daily Show was about. It was the conservatives that could not take a joke and they were the one doing the war on Christmas and George Will was their mascot. And, you know, among the least funny, the least laughable group of people are these fuddy duddy stick in the muds. And now the anarchists seem to be on the right, even if it dabbles into places that are obviously offensive and horrifying to many.
No, I mean, that's completely the case. And of course, the reality is that both of these perspectives, the one on the left that says the right can't joke and they're always just ragers, and the right that the left is can't joke, they're just a bunch of hall monitors, right? Those are caricatures that have never been true. And something that we're doing in the book is, you know, it might sound like we're just sort of like pointing at bad stuff on the right. And then, you know, we're also putting the stuff on the right that we could talk about some of the things we do like that we see in the book. But we're also talking about the left's sort of holding on to this idea from the Jon Stewart era.
Yeah.
That the only people who really can use comedy to do something politically is on the left. You know, there is this other kind of complex we describe. It's sort of a psychological complex, whereas people on the left simply do not accept that the right is laughing, that the right is creating comedy that's really powerful politically. And I think Jon Stewart's the exact right thing to talk about there. Early 2000s, Stewart is the leader of the Democratic Party. Right. Who's going to draw more people at a rally? John Kerry or John Stewart? Right. It's not close. Right. Stewart is the flag bearer. And at that moment, a lot of people, I mean, my age, right, people in late 30s, early 40s, right, really come of political age in the early 2000s. There's a comedian who really represents a liberal point of view, and it really gets baked in the idea that the left is funny and then the right is this, I guess you say, George Will over serious, can't take a joke thing. And now, both, you know, if you people who are not really breaking out of their sort of social media bubbles will think that the other side won't tell a joke, can't tell a joke. It's really a fascinating situation.
All right. A final question here, and it's a big one. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the most accurate political utility of comedy? How effective is it to beyond just making a joke to people that are going to enjoy it? Like, what is the political utility of it?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think and my thinking on this has changed in looking closely at right wing comedy. And the answer I'd give you now is that it is to smooth over differences. We have a two-party system. Right. We have a binary political culture, which means that everybody who votes, at least, is going to be in one of two giant continuums. It's going to be full of contradictions. right? So on the right in particular, you're going to have libertarians who are all about, free speech and free markets. And you're going to have social conservatives who are all about Christian values or something, right? This space that has a tremendous amount of diversity that could spend all of its time fighting against itself. Instead, one thing that it can do is make jokes about the other guy. That you can use comedy to glue together a coalition that doesn't totally make ideological sense, but has this outside space, can create an identity through comedy and kind of glue together sometimes pieces that don't fit without the glue. And so I'd call it coalition building in a way, but it's more like just that first step of coalition building. All right, what is it that we can all do in this right-wing coalition, even though we disagree on a lot of stuff? Well, one thing we can do is laugh in this one direction together. And then, you know, then it becomes that much easier to put together the policy stuff or the whatever else is going to be part of building that coalition.
Yeah. You know, it's a very interesting point you make because, you know, as somebody who is peripherally involved in the world of comedy, boy, is it hard to make a joke that people find funny. And if you can do that and also create a credible political coalition while you're doing it, then that is certainly a talent. Matt, thank you so much. Your brand new book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work, is available now. You and your co-author, Nick Marks, and folks can get that at Amazon.com, or if you hate Amazon.com, go to UC Press. But if you enjoyed this interview and want more of it, then go to Amazon and leave a review because it helps. And we always want to support authors who come on this show. Matt. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Justin. It was a lot of fun.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. If you would like to thank our guest, Matt Sinkowitz, you can do so by heading on over to px3guest.com. You want to send me an email to the show. I suspect we might get a few. Considering we are talking about abortion, then you can do so, theyoungamerican@gmail.com. You can hit us up on Twitter at PX3Tweets. Our Twitch is PX3Live, where I am live Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And then, of course, you can share this podcast with your friends, family, and clergy, PX3Podcast.com. Find our merch at politicsmerch.com. If you'd like to support us with a one-time donation, you can do so, paypal.me/payjury. Our Venmo is justin-young-20, and our Cash App is PX3Cash. Send me anything you'd like physical in the mail. Just go ahead and make it out to Justin Young, P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. Of course, you can get our bonus content at takepoliticsseriously.com. Our $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week, covering all the news that we missed during our free podcast schedule. And our $10 tier gets your name read at the end of the show, like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. V-Guard, Alexis, Neil of Neils, MC Dradio, Unsafe DB Level, Katie, Double K Ranch, Amanda, Yeel, Pinball Shop, John, DP4, Bongo, Niemeister, Nick's Horseless Diner, No Horses Ever, Catherine, Persons Familiar with the Matter, and Vote for Gloria Young for King of the New World Order, 100 Mile Runner, Edison, up, down, left, right, B.A. Start, Dr. G, Headphones, Neil, Charles, Darren, Alex, owner of the Stronger Now Gym in Atlanta, Idris Arslandian, Blue Front, and the Lenina, D.L., Steven, Chad, Nomadic Terran, Diana's Shrill Shrieks, Miranda Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, Redneck Tech is awesome. David, Brad, Richard, D-Laser, Just Another Pilot, Middle-Aged Mike Who Loves, Frank Got Abducted, Utah, Jimmy Montana, The Gen, Adam, LD, Really, Chopper, J-Pink, Andrew, and Josh. If you'd like your name read in that slot, only one place to go, takepoliticsseriously.com. Essay episode coming up on Friday. We are going to take a look at the permanent Democratic majority. Remember that? Permanent Democratic majority. It was very much a believable thing back in the late aughts, early tens. Why it was thought to be possible when it began to fall apart why it is totally destroyed now and if it is about ready to rebound. All discussed on our essay episode about the topic, the permanent Democratic majority, this Friday. Till then, your old pal Justin Robert Young is telling you some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss.
Oh,
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.